My duty tonight is to, on your behalf, welcome Reverend Father John Powell, SJ, to Sydney for his second lecture, and those who have heard his first and experienced the two-day workshop would know, the way I do, how much he has given to Sydney in his visit. So I'd like you to join me in warmly welcoming Father here tonight.
Once when I was using one of these gadgets giving a sermon, I got carried away near the end of my sermon, and I decided to leave the pulpit on a dramatic note. But I forgot that I was using one of these lapel microphones that hooks around your neck. It was nearly the end of me. If you recall, last time I began my talk by saying that my own deepest sense of identity is that of a priest. And theologically, I would define a priest as someone who shares in the role of Jesus as a mediator between God and man, and that therefore the very vocation of priest demands that a man be deeply in touch with the heart of men and women and deeply in touch with the heart of God. And we called our last talk The Heart of Man, and tonight I would like to speak about the heart of God. Some years ago, I was teaching a course at our university in Chicago, Loyola University, in the theology of faith. And I had in my course, as we always do, a resident atheist. His name was Tom. And Tom sort of whined through the whole course. He said he wasn't sure, and I said I wasn't too sure either. But what made things difficult was Tom was the first boy that I saw in my classroom with shoulder-length hair, which he would comb during class. And I used to look at him and say, "Do you shoot that kind or spray them?" And I know in my head, of course, that it doesn't matter how long your hair is. The students had a poster of Albert Einstein, and his hair was all over the place, if you remember. And the caption read, "It isn't what's on your head, it's what's in it that counts." And I know that. But I still took me some time to get used to this boy combing his long flaxen hair in class. At the end of the course, when Tom came up to turn in his final exam, he said, "Father, do you think I will ever find God?" And I said, no, I don't. And he said, "Oh." He walked about 10 steps away, and I said, "Tom, yes, but I'm sure he will find you." He said, "Oh." And he walked out, and I thought, "You missed my line. That was a zinger, you know? And you missed it, dum-dum." But he was gone, and later I heard that Tom was graduated, and then I heard that Tom had cancer. And not long ago, he came into my office, and all that long hair had fallen out because of his chemotherapy treatments, and he was very thin, but his eyes were glistening, and that troubled look that he always had on his face during the Theology of Faith course seemed to be replaced by a look of content. And I said, "Tom, I hear you're sick." And he said, "Cancer in both lungs is pretty sick, isn't it, Father?" I said, "Do you have cancer in both lungs, Tom?" He said, "Yes, I do." I said, "Can you talk about it?" "Yes, sure." "Tom, what's it like to be 24 years old and dying?" "Oh," he said with a smile, "it could be worse." And I said, "Like what? What could be worse, Tom?" And he said, "Oh, being 50 and having no values, thinking that wine, women, and song are the only important things in life, oh, this would be worse." And I remember thinking back to the 7 or 8 years before when I had that boy in class, and I secretly, in my own mental file case, had filed him under C for creep. And I keep thinking that God has a unique way of embarrassing me. He sends back the people that I write off. He sends them back to educate me. And as this boy was sitting in front of me, telling me that he was really ready to die, a thing I'm not sure I'm ready to do. He was facing death far more fearlessly than I think I would be facing death. Tom was educating me. I always thought that if he got an idea, it would die of lonesomeness. And he comes back, and he's telling me about how he's ready to die. And then he said, "You know why I came back to see you?" And I said, "Why, Tom?" He said, "Well, it was the last day of class. Do you remember that, when I turned in my final exam? And I asked you if you thought I would ever find God. And you said, no." And I was surprised at that answer, because I thought that was the product you were pushing. But he said, "When I got 10 steps away from you, you said, 'But he's going to find you, Tom. Sure of that. That's what I want to talk to you about.'" He said, "You know, when I was in your course, I was looking for God. I was reasonably sincere about that, but it wasn't the obsession of my life. And it wasn't until after I was graduated and the doctors found a lump in my groin, and when they removed it, they said, 'It's cancer.' And then I really began looking for God. And the surgeons told me that they thought they had it all. But later they said, 'No, we didn't get it all. It has metastasized. There is a secondary cancerous growth.' And then I began beating on the doors of heaven, the bronze doors of heaven, and saying, 'God, if you're in there, please speak to me. Please come out. I'm dying. God, I have 3 to 6 months to live.' And I want to tell you, Father, that there was no answer. And I felt that my knuckles were bloody, beating on the doors of heaven. And I tried. But God was not willing to talk to me. And then one day I woke up and I no longer cared. Have you ever tried something for a long time and you try so hard for so long and you have no success, and then one day you wake up and you say, 'I really don't care.'" And one morning I woke up and I said, "I really don't care." But I remembered something else that you said in your class. You said, "It would be a pity if you went out of this world and you never told the people that you had loved that you loved them." And I remembered that. That impressed me when you said it. And you told us about your father. You told us how your father went out of this world and you realized only after he was dead that he had never told you that he loved you, or that he was proud of you, and that you had never told him that you loved him. And I remember feeling very sad for you. And so I went to my father, and I thought, "Oh, this is going to be hard." My father was sitting there with a newspaper, and I said, "Dad," and he said, "What?" And I said, "Dad, I want to tell you something." He said, "Well, tell me." I said, "Dad, I love you." He said, "You what?" He said, "I love you. I know I caused you a lot of worry. I know there were times when I disobeyed you. I know there were times when you must have wondered what would ever happen to me, but I want to tell you something, Dad. I really loved you." And he said, "My father did something I have never seen my father do. He cried." My father cried. And then he did something that was even more unexpected than the tears. He stood up and he hugged me. My father hugged me. And you have to understand how undemonstrative my father is to know what a moment that was in my life. My father hugged me. And you know what we did? We stayed up We stayed up and we talked almost all through the night. It was the first time I ever really talked to my father about things that matter, about the deep things inside of both of us. And he told me he loved me too. And then I went to my mother, and it was the same thing, and even to my little brother. My little brother cried too. I told him, kid, I know I pushed you around. I know I wouldn't take you with me when I went out. I know, but listen. What I want you to remember when you think of me in some year to come, remember that I love you. All I ask of you is forever to remember me as loving you. And then he said, Father, one day while I was in this process, I turned around and there was God. There was God. There was the God that wouldn't come to me. There was the God that didn't speak to me, the elusive God who didn't seem interested in me. He was there. He was filling my life. And I was praying to him, and he was responding to me. And he was preparing me to die. He was canceling out all my fears. And that's what I wanted to tell you. And I remember sitting there and saying, Tom, I think you're telling me something much more universal than just your experience. I think you're telling me something about the way that we must really find God. And he said, I know. I am telling you something more universal. He said, when I was telling God, come on, God, come on, I have 3 to 6 months to live, what I was really saying to him is, you have to be on my timetable. All those years that I was willing to let you wait in the wings of the stage so that at this dramatic moment I could say, come out, you didn't do that. You didn't want to help me deceive myself that I could do that to you. You didn't want to be like a trained dog jumping through my hoop. Come on, jump through my hoop. But when I turned out of myself, when I went out to love, I found you. And I said to Tom, would you come? Would you come back to my Theology of Faith course and tell that story, Tom? Because there are other kids like you who are sitting now in my present Theology of Faith course, and they need to know that. And he said, oh, I don't know if I'm ready for a classroom. So would you think about it? Would you pray about it? And would you remember, they need you. These kids need you. If I walk in there, as you once said, that's the product you're pushing. But when you walk in there, Tom, and I tell him, here's a 24-year-old kid, and he's dying. The chips are down. There's no use putting on an act now. He's got cancer in both lungs. If you tell them, Tom, he said, I'll think about it. I really will. And he called me about a week or two later, and he said, I'm ready for your class. And we set a date. But before that date arrived, Tom was taken to the hospital, and he died. But before he died in there in the hospital, he said to me, I guess I'm not going to be able to tell your class. Would you tell them? I said, yes, Tom. I will tell them. I'll tell them for you. Something that seems very important to me in that story is that it is when we are really willing to open up in love that God comes into our lives, that we begin to understand God when we begin to understand what it is to love. I remember, because my own parents lived more of a truce than a marriage, I remember wondering, are there any happy marriages? And then I became acquainted with a movement that is now international, the Marriage Encounter Movement. And I began to find that this Marriage Encounter Movement was producing people who really knew what it was to love, that the freshness of love was never lost because they were communicating in the marriage encounter. And I remember what a great consolation that was to me. But I found something else about these same people. I found that in the new discovery of each other, there was a simultaneous discovery of God. And they seemed to be telling me what Tom was telling me, that God is love. And God is found in the act of loving. God is love. Whoever abides in God in love abides in God. Whoever abides in God abides in love. I remember when I was asked to keynote the Jewish expression of the marriage encounter movement in Long Island, New York, I was picked up at the airport by a Jewish couple, and they were driving me to the scene of the convention, and I asked them, could you tell me, in summary form, what is the marriage encounter meant to you? And the man said, oh, he said, it's really simple. For me, the biggest change in me is very obvious. I used to be an atheist. God is love, and whoever abides in God abides in love. I think it's very important to understand this, that God really is love. And I think it's very important that you and I understand that this is the very nature of God, and that this means that all God ever does is love. The book of Genesis tells us that God made us to his image and likeness. And I would think that the most perduring heresy in human history is that we have made God to our image and likeness. We have projected into God things that were never there. Wrath, anger, the desire to punish. These things are not and never have been in God. God is never angry. Of course, even the scriptures speak about the wrath of God, but that's a figure of speech. All the scripture scholars say, to be sure that you understand that this does not mean something in God. There is no anger in God. God is immutably, unchangeably loving. And that's all God ever does is love. All God ever asks is that we remember him as loving us, asking us, what do you need me to be? What would be for your greater good? Because that's what I want. I want your happiness. To really know that God is love and that God wants our happiness much more than we do. Most of us are like Francis Thompson's person in The Hound of Heaven, running from God, afraid that he's our competitor. He's going to take away from us. And God is like the sun. All he ever does is love. He sends off the warmth and the light of his love to us. And we can put a parasol over our head. We can go inside where the sun cannot reach us. We can lock ourselves in a dark dungeon. But just as the sun goes on shining, the sun does not change because we leave it. So God always loves. God is always loving, always offering us the warmth and the light of his love. The terms, the wrath of God, the anger of God, the punishment of God, all these things are very misleading terms. There's nothing like that in God. The only change that takes place in sin when we leave God, when we go away from the sunlight of God's love, is in us. God does not change. And it's very important to know this, that you can always walk back into the light, no matter what. No matter where you've been or what you've done, the sun of God's love is shining. Now, I'm sure that this is accurate theology. I'm only sorry that it isn't preached more. Because so many people, when they think of God, their image of God, their concept of God that controls their relationship with God is of a competitor, a taskmaster, a tyrant, someone who is marking us down. And I say to people, think about this. Close your eyes sometime and think about this. If God could appear to you and say one thing, what would he say? If God could make one facial expression at you, what would it be? And I'm afraid that most people think that if God had one thing to say, it would be, when are you going to shape up? And if God could make one facial expression, he would probably scratch his head and give you a pained look, as though you were a walking case of something contagious. And I'm sure God would say, I love you. Oh, I love you. I remember one time, I have a doctor friend who has a little boy who's seriously retarded. And the doctor and I were sitting out in his backyard on lawn chairs talking, and the little boy came out. And he was standing looking at me, and because he was retarded, I really didn't know what to do, whether I should say something to him or just let him take the temperature of the water himself. So the doctor and I went on talking, and the first time I talked in the conversation, the little boy jumped up in my lap. And the doctor said, did you see what he did? He came out, he watched you, he was looking at you, but even to his mind, which is not fully functioning, it's retarded, he had to hear you. And he must have heard something that was warm, reassuring, inviting, and then he knew he could come to you. He knew he could climb up into your lap. And this is what we do with everyone. You and I do this. We all want to be open and loving. We really do. We have a need to do that. But we're watching people. We watch them and we listen to them and we say, if I open up to you, will you be gentle? And I listen to you talk about other people, and if you are judgmental of others, I say, I see blood under your fingernails. And I don't want my blood there. And so I put up a mask. But we do that with one another. Even within a marriage, very often. They say when people don't open up, when they aren't open, it's because they think they have something to fear. And they are waiting and watching. Can I be open? Or will you punish me? Will you laugh at me? Will you reject me? Now, I think the same thing that we do with one another, the way we watch. We watch all the signs. We turn on this thing called intuition. We do with God. We say, God, can I feel safe with you? And the most important concept, the most important idea inside of us, as far as religion is concerned, is who do you think God is? We are all accustomed to sit on the curbstones of life and have identity crises. We're saying, who am I? Who am I? And a much more profitable question is, who are you, oh my God? Who are you that you love me? Not who am I, but who are you that you love me, oh God? This is, as I say, a controlling concept. And in the prophet Isaiah, God says, who am I? I'm the one who loves you. I have loved you with an eternal love. I have always loved you, you by name. I have carved your name in the palms of my hands so I would never forget you. If a mother were to forget the child of her womb, I would never forget you. I love you. All I ask of you is forever to remember me as loving you. I think that this is so important. If I were teaching religion to little children, I would teach them this. I would drench their minds in this revelation of God. I have loved you. I have loved you. And I would wash away all the distortions, all the projections, the anthropomorphisms in which we project our angers and our wrath and our punishment into God, who is love, who is only love, who is only the shining sun waiting for us to come back when we have wandered away. I have loved you. I have always loved you. The thing about God's love that we must understand is that it is unconditional. That God says, I have given you my love. We are always trying to change so God can love us, and God is saying to us, you've got it backwards, and it doesn't work the way you've got it. I have loved you so you can change. I have loved you first. We all know that. People say, if you change, I will love you. That's conditional love. If you pass the admission test, I will give you my love. And that kind of love really helps no one. But the person who says, I give you my love is a given, you have it. And then that kind of love becomes energizing in a human being. And then we can change. You can only really become a saint after you know that God really loves you. He loves you no matter what. Then you have the power to change. Then you have the energies that are wasted regretting who you are and accusing yourself and destroying yourself with criticism and self-hatred. All those energies can be released into love and into growth and to give glory to God. But you've got to know He loves you. And I think this is very important. In the teaching of Jesus, when the apostles asked him, when we talk to the Father, to God, what should we call him? And Jesus said, oh, call him Abba. Abba. The Hebrew word Abba is a tender word for father, like dad, daddy, papa. Call him Abba, Jesus said. Abba is a word that suggests things like a child sitting in his father's lap, a child resting in his father's arms. The poet Rilke, the Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke, said that he felt like a child held in the arms of a sleeping child in the arms of God, and the child looks up, wakes out of his sleep, and looks up and sees that he is really being held in his father's arms. And he closes his eyes again, and he feels safe, and he goes back to sleep. This is Abba. This is my father. This is what Jesus said, oh, call him Abba. And to have that sense of trust. And Jesus said, do you see the lilies of the field and the birds of the air? My father takes care of them. The Father who loves you, your Abba. The Holy Spirit has been sent into your heart so that you may call out of your heart, to instruct your heart, that God is your Abba, He is your Father. Feel safe. He is your Father. And to really let go, to really understand this unconditional love of God, this wiping out of your concept of God, those heretical concepts like anger and wrath and the desire to punish, they're not there. They're not in God. But worst of all, like the little retarded boy waiting to hear you speak so he knows he can come up and climb up into your lap, we are waiting to understand our God as Abba before we go running to him. In the head of the book, it is written of me that to do your will, Abba, is all my delight. Behold, I come running. You must know that he is your Abba. He is your Father. He loves you. Your name is carved in his hands, and your name is written in his heart. He loves you. Of course, the great revelation of who God is Jesus. St. John, at the beginning of his gospel, says that God, who has kept this secret from all eternity, God is now going to reveal the secret of the world. He utters his word into the world. The word becomes flesh and dwells among us. The word of God. The word of God, that he is our Abba. That we are brothers and sisters. That the very life of God unites us as no blood ties ever could. There are no strangers anymore. There are just brothers and sisters we have not met because he is our Abba. This Jesus came to the world to be what St. Paul calls the visible image of our invisible God, that we, in knowing Jesus, might know the Father. Jesus is a pointer. Jesus is saying, this is what God is like. And I love to think about Jesus and the way he dealt with his apostles. I love to think that those poor, weak men all became great men, and all except John died martyrs because they knew that Jesus loved them. When he first called them, he was walking by the Jordan River, and John the Baptist was down in the Jordan, and he sees his cousin Jesus walk by, and he calls two of his apostles over, Andrew and John, and he says, there he is, Andy, Johnny, come here. Go follow them. That's the Lamb of God. All that we've been doing here is a preparation. Go follow him. And like two little boys, Johnny later writes this story up in his gospel. And I hope you will understand that I'm not ad-libbing, that this is really what happened. These two men are walking after Jesus like little boys, and because John the Baptist told them to. And Jesus turns around and said, what do you want? And they don't know what to say. They look at each other. And they had to make up something fast. And they said, where do you live? And Jesus says, come and see. Come and see where I live. And they go after Jesus. And John writes in his gospel that they spent the rest of the day with him. And then John and Andrew discover that Jesus is the Messiah. And Andrew goes to his older brother and says, Si, wait till you hear this. We have found the Messiah. And Simon, the older brother, says, oh, come on, Andy. You know, you got an overheated imagination. You didn't find the Messiah. He said, we did. He said, well, let your older brother look at him, all right? And so this poor man, Simon, he goes to Jesus, and Jesus changes his name right there and then, which to us might not be important, but to a Jew, when you change his name, you change his life. You said, I have a different destiny for you. He said, from this point on, you will be known as the Rock. Well, nobody was ever known as the Rock before. The Aramaic word that Jesus used, kepha, means a slab of rock. And that poor man, he didn't understand. What do you mean I'm not going to be Simon, the son of Jonah, anymore? I'm going to be a slab of rock. That's what you're going to be. And so he called them together. Mark tells us in his gospel that he called them together that they might travel with him. They left house and home. But Peter had one important question to remember before he was willing to go. He said, what's in it for us? I mean, you know, we're going to leave everything. And he made it sound rather great, for they were very poor fishermen. In all the whole gospels, they are never recorded as catching a fish. Except on the one occasion where Jesus says, lower the net here. And they say, there are no fish there. And he says, lower the net anyway. And they said, look, I mean, you're talking to a lot of old salts here. We know this Sea of Galilee like our mother's kitchen. He said, would you just try it? So they said, well, let's humor him. And they lower the net. Holy smoke, you know, the net starts to break. It's the only time they're recorded as catching a fish. Well, Peter says, what's in it for us? And Jesus is very patient. And he says, I promise you, if you leave everything for me, I promise you 100-fold of joy in this life, and I promise you life eternal. And so they go, the reluctant apostles. There was Peter, the man who was supposed to be a rock, who was mostly a sand pile. You know, the fastest gum in the East. He answered rhetorical questions. Always had an opinion, and most of the time was wrong. You know, after that one, after the one place where he gets off that good answer that's recorded in Matthew 16:16. Right after that, Jesus said he predicts his passion and death, and Peter the loudmouth says, No, absolutely not. It'll never happen. And Jesus is pretty strong with him. He says, Peter, you're not thinking as God thinks. You're thinking as men think. No one's taking away my life. I'm laying it down as an act of love. Greater love than this no man has. He's pretty hard on Peter. But Peter Peter needed someone to confront him. Peter always had an answer. And then there was the two boys, Jimmy and Johnny, the Sons of Thunder. I think you know why they were called the Sons of Thunder. Because after they passed through one place where they were not very well treated, they suggested to Jesus that we burn the place down. Now, this is true now. I hope you don't think I'm just trying to entertain you. If it's entertaining, then you find the gospel entertaining. But this is in the gospel. They say, you know, let's call down lightning and thunder on this place and really burn it up. We'll show them. Jimmy and Johnny, the Sons of Thunder. Their mama, Salome, not the dancer, comes to Jesus, and they're pretty wealthy, you know. Zebedee's pretty wealthy. He must have a fleet of ships or something, because it's thought that they financed most of the preaching tours of Jesus and the apostles. And Mama Salome goes to Jesus, and she got Jimmy and Johnny waiting there in the wings of the stage, and she said, Jesus, when you set up this kingdom of yours, you know, you're going to need someone to take charge, right? A president and a vice president, your number one and two men? How about it? Make my boys your number one and two men. And they're standing there in all due modesty, grinning that we can do it, you know. And Jesus says, oh, madam, I don't think you know what you're asking. And he turns to the boy and said, can you drink the chalice I will drink? And they said, spot on. I can do it. Yes, sir. And Jesus smiled. The Sons of Thunder. And then there was a fellow named Tom. Thomas is called Thomas the Twin, and no twin ever shows up. So the fathers of the church, and this is true again, you can trust me, the fathers of the church said that's because he had a dual personality. He was called Twin. That there was Tom, the nice guy, and there was Tom, the bullhead. Tom, who never believed anything. You remember when Jesus appeared to the apostles after his resurrection and Thomas was missing. And when he came back to the upper room, they said, Tom, Jesus is risen. He said, oh, come on. You're not dealing with some rube from the country. Oh. What? Is there a doctor in the house, please? Is there a doctor here, please? You find one? Die? Where was I? Tom was a bullhead. And then there was the naive Andy and Phil, who, when they had 15,000 people to feed, brought up a little boy with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. These were the men that Jesus picked. And I have to say that everything we've been talking about was true. They were weak. And when Jesus says at the Last Supper, Peter, you're going to deny me, the rock says, not the rock. You've got to be thinking of one of the others, not the rock. He said, no, Peter, you will. Before the cock crows, you will deny me 3 times. And he says, it's absolutely impossible. The man is really confident. And there's no worse combination than being weak and confident. And when Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Olives to be taken to Caiaphas, the high priest, the rock is following, and he's warming his hands in the court of the palace. And I'm sure I understand this man. If Jesus asserts his power and the palace falls apart and Jesus walks out, Peter's going to step forward and say, I'm his number one man. You're looking at the rock. Want to talk to someone with a little authority? Talk to me. But if Jesus doesn't, if he persists in this Lamb of God reaction, Peter will say, I'm just warming my hands. Is there a law against that? And when Jesus doesn't, when he's brought out and his arms are tied behind him, Peter's in the act of denying Jesus. He's saying, I don't know who he is. And some little girl says, oh, come on, I can tell by your accent. You're Galilean. I saw you with him. He said, look, I swear an oath before Almighty God that I don't even know who he is. And when he turns around, he's face to face with Jesus. And the gospel says that the rock went out and cried his heart out. That's all he could do. And the next time he sees Jesus, Jesus says, and remember this, all those apostles left Jesus in his moment of agony except John. They all stayed up in that upper room, and they had the door bolted, and their knees were knocking, and their breath was bated, and their teeth were chattering. You know what they were afraid of? That they might get hurt. Jesus is being scourged and nailed to the cross, and they're worried. What if they try to make a clean sweep of Christianity? We've had it. And they're afraid. And if you don't ever remember anything else that Jesus ever said, or any other Hebrew word, you have to remember what Jesus said when he came to them. They were unwilling to share his passion with him, but when he arose, the first people with whom he shared his victory were these men, because he loved them. And you've got to understand this, that this is what love does. Love doesn't write off someone because he fails. Love says, I love you. And Jesus comes, and he comes to the upper room, and he's predicted that he will rise from the dead. And these clunkers are saying, oh my God, we are seeing a ghost. They somehow believe that it's mass hallucination or something. And Jesus is saying, no, wait. It's I. Look, did you ever see a ghost with flesh and bones? Come on, come over here and touch this. Hey, how about giving me some fish and honeycomb? Watch my Adam's apple as I chew it. So patient and so loving. But when he first comes in to these men, his first word is shalom. Remember that word, shalom. Be at peace. Poor Peter, who said to Jesus, depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man, don't even come near me. Jesus says, shalom. And if ever you feel that you have been weak, if ever you feel that you have wandered away, that you've been unwilling to share in the light of Jesus, remember shalom. Shalom. Be at peace, I understand. I never expected you to be perfect. I love you. It's so hard to accept unconditional love. I love you. I love you. And you know what's really nice? That these poor men, they stayed with Jesus, and they all died martyrs. They became great men. There's only one man who couldn't accept unconditional love. His name was Judas. And poor Judas, you know, he had a little plan, and it backfired. And I'm sure his plan was not to really betray Jesus. His plan was to get the kingdom started. He thought if he could bring the power of Jesus and the power of Rome into conflict, the power of Jesus would triumph and the kingdom would be started and he would be an important man. Poor Judas. He didn't believe in unconditional love. He would not let God love him. He didn't believe he'd go back to Jesus and would receive shalom. So he hanged himself. And the gospel is strangely detailed on this, that he put the halter of a horse around his neck and the other end around the branch of a tree hanging out over a cliff, and he walked off the cliff, and the branch broke, and Judas broke on the ground. It almost seems to me that this business of love, of accepting a God of love, is an absolute necessity, that the only other alternative is death. To believe in shalom. And poor Peter, who was such a sandpile, when he came to die, you know the story of Quo Vadis. That it was the year 67 AD, about 30 years after Jesus died, the persecution of Christians is going on, and Peter is walking out of Rome on the Via Appia, the Appian Way. And he meets a vision of Jesus, an apparition of Jesus. And he says, Quo Vadis, Domine? And Jesus said, I'm going back to Rome to die and die and die. In the lion's den, on the crosses, I'm going to die in every one of my Christians. And Jesus and Peter walked back to Rome together. And the story is that when Peter came to be martyred, they were going to crucify him, and he said, "Could you do me a favor? My Lord died straight up, and I'm not worthy to die in the same position. Would you crucify me head down?" And there in the little chapel on the Appian Way outside of Rome, in a little church, there are two mosaics in the sanctuary. One of Jesus on his cross, and the other Peter, upside down, his throat cut, and his blood running into the ground. A great man, a great man. But his greatness was the product of Jesus' love, of Jesus' patient, constant love. When Peter denied Jesus and they meet again, Jesus asks him only one question, not why did you do it? He asks him only, do you love me? Do you love me? I don't care where you've been, what you've done. Do you love me is what's important. Do you love me, Peter? Someone wrote a little verse, a man named Ed Willock, wrote a verse about all the great sinners that have been converted into saints, starting with Mary Magdalene and Peter. And the last line of this verse is, with God, your wasness doesn't matter if your isness really am. But of course, one of the most beautiful expressions of this unconditional accepting love that knows your name, that has your name engraved in its heart, was when the Pharisees did not understand at all how Jesus could be so soft on sinners. He's eating, which is a sign of intimacy with prostitutes and tax collectors. Evil men and women of all kind, and he's associating with them. And they cannot stand this. And they say to Jesus one day, "What does God think of a sinner?" You know, they are so self-righteous. Jesus called them whitened sepulchres, all shiny, white on the outside. You've never admitted that you're a sinner. I'm the divine physician. I did not come for those who are well. I came for those who are sick, who need me. Don't you understand? When they press this question, what does God think of a sinner? What does God think of someone who was wandered away from me? Told the famous story that everyone knows of the prodigal son. And I would like you to allow me to put that in the language of our own day. I see the point of the parable as two sons living with their father on a country farm. And the young boy, we don't know what happened to him, but he suddenly had it with the chickens and crickets. And he goes to his father and he said, "Dad, in one word, you're obsolete. You know, I mean, this life on the farm just isn't for me because I belong to the go-go generation. And what I want is my inheritance now so I can go off to the big city because I got to live and I got a lot of living to do." And the father says, I really need you here now. Are you going to leave me?" He said, "Oh," he said, "you have the picture. I am going to leave you. And I please, no sermons, just cash." And so the young boy takes his inheritance that the father reluctantly gives him. And the father allows him to leave. And he doesn't look back over his shoulder. But every night the father sits on the front porch of the little farmhouse in the country waiting for his boy to come home. And the people coming in from the town look at the father and they say, some kid you got there, mister. You ought to see your little blue-eyed boy in the big city. You ought to see what a corrupt person he is, seducing every woman he can, drunk. He's living it up. You should be declared Father of the Year. You have a great little boy there." But the father waits every night. And then the son runs out of money and he runs out of friends and he decides to go home. And in the gospel, Jesus, in his parable, is very explicit. The boy prepares an act of contrition. And it goes like this. I'm not worthy, Dad, to be taken back as your son. But, you know, I was really hungry. You know what I was eating? The swill they feed to pigs. Dad, would you take me back as a hired hand? I remember how good you were to the hired hands on your farm. Would you take me back as a hired hand? And when he gets home, the father, sitting on the porch waiting, sees the form of his son coming down the road. And he knows what only love would observe. He knows the way his son swings his arms. And he runs out. And read this carefully sometime in the Gospels. The boy starts his act of contrition, but he never gets it out. He gets out only the first line, and he's smothered in the embrace of his father. And he feels his father's sobs deep within his chest and his father's tears running down his cheek. And then he hears his father call out, "Get out the rings and the robes. Kill the fatted calf, the best one we have, and start roasting it. Get in some musicians now. I want the music makers in here. We're going to have a party to end all parties." And when the party is in full swing, the older boy comes in from the fields and he asks one of the hired hands, "What's happening?" And the hired hand said, "The kid came home tonight." "My brother?" "Yep. Your little brother's home and your dad's having a big party for him. Try that on your zither." And the older boy says to the hired hand, "You go in there and you tell my father I will never put foot in that house as long as that kid's there. Tell him." And the father comes out to his older boy and says, "What is it, son?" "What is it? Are you serious? What is it? Look at this face. I'm the one who stayed here. And look at these hands. See those calluses? That's from working on this farm. Doing twice the work because he left. I was here the night he left. I was here when he told you about having had it with the chickens and crickets, that you were obsolete. I remember when he told you, 'No sermon, Pops, just cash.' I remember that. I remember how the people coming in from the town ridiculed you. And I remember when you would go into your room at night to go to bed, and the sun went down and there was no more hope of seeing him. I remember hearing you sob. He broke your heart. And now he comes home and you have a party for him. Isn't that something? You have a party for him. And you never gave a party for me. You never gave me a party for me and my friends. You never killed a fatted calf. Me and my friends, and I'm the one who stayed here." And the father, in the parable of Jesus, who represents God, the father says, "Yes, of course, I understand what you're saying, and everything I have is yours. Anytime you want to have a party for you and your friends, you can have it. You can have anything you want, but there is one thing I ask. Would you try to understand what goes on in the heart of a father when his child comes home to him? Would you try to understand, please, what happens in a father's heart when he thinks his child is lost and he finds him? When he thinks his child is sick and he's well? When he thinks his child is dead and he finds him alive again? Would you try to understand that?" And when Jesus finished this parable, in answer to the question, "What does God think of a sinner?" He says, "That's what God thinks of a sinner." To understand how God feels about us in our weakness, in our weak human condition, in which we fail, you have to understand that. What happens in the heart of a father when his child comes home? We have to understand the heart of God by understanding the heart of Jesus. This God who is love, as much as we talk about it in all the analogies that we devise to explain God's love, like the sunlight, all becomes concrete in the life and the love of Jesus. the Jesus of the prostitutes and the tax collectors, the Jesus of do you love me, Peter, the Jesus who says shalom. And I think it certainly happened in my life, and I think it must happen in the life of all of us, that sometime when we look at ourselves and we become discouraged, we have to stop asking, who am I, and look up and ask, who are you, oh my God? And hear the word that God always has ready in these moments, shalom. Be at peace, I understand. During the talk, someone became possibly seriously sick, possibly suffered a heart attack. Could we say a prayer, please, for him? Lord Jesus, we ask you to be with our brother, and if it is your will to give him full restoration of health, and to give him and those he loves and those who love him strength and courage and faith at this moment, we thank you. Amen. What I would like to talk about now is union with this God. How do we find this God? How does he find us? And it seems to me, at least, that it's very important to understand this, because we all have struggles with faith. If someone says, I have no struggles with faith, why, it's perfectly apparent to me, I think that person has never really opened to the very question of faith. This whole possibility that everything I have been saying is true is all based on God's revelation. We don't make up this God. He reveals himself to us. And his great word, his summary word of revelation is Jesus, his son. But we must accept this God, not because we can prove it. You could never prove in a million years that the God who sprung the stars in the sky and made the mountains and the oceans, that God is your tender Abba. You could never prove that. And I think sometimes when we try to convince people of faith and say, you know, you should be a believer, we are failing to recognize that faith is a gift of God. And I think this is really important. That's why there can never be an argument about faith between a believer and a non-believer. It's all a matter of experience. It's all a matter of experiencing God. And I think that we have to somehow believe that God can, inside of us, act on our minds so that we can truly say, it is true. What God has revealed in Jesus, it is true. But only when God empowers us. And I ask the students I teach in the Theology of Faith course, can God put an idea in your mind? Could God do that? Can God act internally in us, in our faculties? Because if the answer is no, if you believe that God can't or doesn't, then I don't see any possibility of faith. Because faith is not a logical exercise. You can't reason your way into faith. You can't say, I have thought the matter over and come to this decision. It's not a matter of logic. It's a matter of God touching you. It's a matter of God acting in your mind, empowering you to believe. If I were to tell you on a human level that I love you, you could never prove that. You could say, well, you act like or you don't act like you love me, but you could never prove it. The only way you could ever know that I love you is to believe me. You've got to believe me. It's something you can't prove. And when God says to us through Jesus, I love you, there is no way you can prove or disprove this. That's why some of the most brilliant people are beautiful believers, and some of the most naturally brilliant people are atheists. They are non-believers. Because it isn't a matter of intelligence. It isn't a matter of logic. It's a matter of experiencing the touch of God. And so if someone says, I don't believe, there's no apologetic of belief that can convince him. You have only to say something like, well, read the New Testament and see whether God will touch you or not.
or go away and make a retreat. Give yourself silence to explore your own inner spaces, or reach out in love to someone else. But you must await the touch of God. God alone can make us believers. And I remember when I was a 17-year-old boy and I entered the Jesuit novitiate, I had no idea that it would be so Spartan. They dressed us up in long black cassocks, skirts, you know, and we spoke Latin all day. We called each other carissime, which if you know Latin means dearly beloved. And we knelt down on wooden kneelers for at least 3 hours a day. We all had such thick calluses on our knees that when we went in for the military physical exam, we had to take the exam, the doctor looked at our knees and asked us, "Do you shoot craps for a living?" And one day I remember walking along the corridor of the novitiate, and I think you probably understand this, that when you put more weight on your faith has to grow deeper roots. But there's that terrible moment, that shaky moment of chaos when you're not sure. I am convinced that as we go through life, doubt eats away the old form of faith so that a new form of faith can be born. And then some more doubt comes and eats away that form of faith, but always so that a deeper and stronger faith can be born. So that there are such things as crises of faith that are normal and natural in the process of our relationship with God. Well, I was walking along the Jesuit novitiate corridor one day, and it suddenly occurred to me that this was all right, if there was a God. But it occurred to me that if there was no God, if this thing was a hoax, that I could not think of a spookier way to spend my life. How to pour your life down a futile drain in one easy lesson. And I even thought in my mind, it may sound a bit irreverent to you, I hope it doesn't, about the possibility of Jesus really being just a nice rabbi who was crucified. And that after his death, Peter got the others together and said, "I guess it's back to the boats and nets, fellas. Unless..." Now listen, and don't get excited. "Unless he is risen." Now think about it. Just think about it. Wouldn't that be something? Now I know some good rumor starters in this community. Mrs. Goldfarb is great. And all we gotta do is tell her, "We saw him, he rose." It'll be all over town. Now this is not exactly a bad thing I'm proposing. Well, I was thinking this way in the novitiate, thinking, what if that happened? And here I am in my black skirt saying, "Carissime." One of the worst things was they got us up at 5 o'clock every morning by ringing a big bell and saying, "Benedicamus Domino, let us bless the Lord." And to be a good novice, you were supposed to leap out of your bed screaming, "Deo gratias." Thanks be to God. Which were not my sentiments at all. So in my moment when faith seemed a pretty chancy thing, I went to the novices' chapel, which was a little small chapel, and I knelt down and I said, "Okay, I'm ready." And nothing happened. I said, "Now wait a minute, now just a minute. I mean, you gotta give me some reassurance here." And nothing happened. And I said, "Are you there?" You know, I felt like the apostles in the boat when Jesus was sleeping. "Hey, I'm drowning." And nothing happened. So I went down to the big community chapel. I figured maybe I'd get some attention down there. It's a bigger place, you know. And nothing happened there. So I went to the master novices and I said, "Father, you won't believe this. I don't even believe it myself. I've lost my faith." And he must have been trained by Carl Rogers, because he always said, no matter what you said, he always said, mm-hmm. And I said, Father, I'm pretty sure you didn't get what I just said. I mean, I lost my faith. And he said, mm-hmm. And then I think he told me to take a walk or to take a nap or something. I thought, that's a funny prescription for loss of faith, take a walk. And I remember he told me to be patient. And I always wonder, what should I be patient for? And that took for about 4 months. I was being patient, going through motions, calling everybody Carissime. And one night, I remember, we had little lights on our desk, and it was in the spring of the first year of my novitiate, and there was a moth trying to get through the screen to get to the light on my desk. And he would come, and he'd go ping, and hit the screen, and drop down, and he'd swoop around, ping. And I remember looking out at him and saying, very compassionately, I know how you feel, fella. I mean, they told me there was a light, too, you know? And it's always ping, and you hit the screen. So far, no nirvana. And then one night, we were supposed to examine our conscience at 8:45 every night. And we had to put a block kneeler in front of the desk and kneel down and go over all the bad things you thought or did that day. And I was putting the kneeler in place, and I thought, this is the only thing I'm really good at. Getting the kneeler in place. After that, you know, it's not much of anything. And I went out, and you're supposed to stand at a distance of a few feet from your kneeler, and I went out there, and all of a sudden God touched me. I never knew it could happen. All of a sudden I felt filled with the presence of God. It was the most beautiful thing that ever happened in my whole life. When it happened, I just stood there crying and thinking, I didn't know what this could happen. I felt like God was blowing me up, filling me up with ecstasy, and I didn't know whether I could hold it all. And honest to goodness, I always thought I had a very happy life, but I thought in that moment, I've never been happy before this. Boy, I see what the saints meant, you know, that there's no pleasure like the touch of God. So it was just an overpowering experience of His presence within me. And I remember going back to the master novices and saying, hey, wait till you hear what happened. And he said, mm-hmm. The touch of God. And I think that there are experiences of God that alone really make us believers. And I think this is really important, that to get to know this God, you must experience Him. Like to really get to know another human being, you must experience that person. And so I'm much more concerned with, not with preaching ideas at people, but getting them into the place and into the frame of mind and into the openness that God can touch them. Now, what I would like to suggest to you tonight is that God's touch is much more available than maybe you think it is. One day I told my class that God speaks to me rather regularly. I figure if you're going to drop a name, drop the big one. And I was walking out of my class behind two boys who did not know I was walking behind them. And I heard one of them say to the other, I wish God would speak to me the way He does to Powell. And I didn't want to interrupt because I thought they might be embarrassed. But I keep wanting to say to people, I think God is much more available than we have been led to believe He is. And this is what I mean by that. I think that the kind of prayer I would like to suggest and want you to try, if you will, if you feel that it makes any sense to you, is what I call dialogical prayer, the prayer of dialogue with God. Now, when you pray this way, you go to God and you tell Him first who you are. You know, unless I tell you who I really am, if I put on an act for you, there's no possibility that we can interact. If I give you a mask, you know, if I raise my heaven-swept eyes and tell you that the only concern in my whole life is the greater glory of God, you know, you don't know whether to go blind or vomit. But that isn't me. That isn't how I feel. And very often when you read prayers out of prayer books and you're saying, oh, Heavenly Father, because you're reading it, I am filled with the sweetest sentiments of faith, hope, and charity, and you're really filled with homicidal thoughts. And I say, That is a very poor way to begin prayer, because you have done what you do when you wear a mask to another person. You have put up a buffer between you and the other person. That person can't reach you, and you can't reach that person if you're not being authentic, if you're not saying, this is who I am. So, for the first 15 minutes of your prayer time, try to reach deep inside your inner spaces and just listen to what's going on in there and report it to God. This is how I feel, God. I feel very much afraid. Or I feel very, very doubtful about you. I feel very unlovable. I don't know how you could ever love me. Whatever you feel. And the one thing you have to do is use as your chief rubric, honesty. The minute you start to talk to God the way you think someone should talk to God, you will diminish your possibilities of real contact. You know, I really like the way Jeremiah prayed. You know, Jeremiah said to God, "You didn't make a prophet out of me," he said with doubled fists. "You made a fool out of me." Because nobody ever listened to Jeremiah. Jeremiah was a young kid when God first chose him, and we think he had a stutter. Because at one place in the revelation of Jeremiah, the people make fun of him and say, little boy, go home. And so Jeremiah, when God said to him, "I want you to be my prophet," he said, "You're kidding. Me?" And God said, "Yes, I want you." And then nothing ever worked out right. And he said to God, "You made a fool out of me. That's what you did." And I think, good. That's real prayer. Old Job, you know, sitting on the pile of manure saying, "I curse the day you ever made me." I said, fine, that's real prayer. Because that's the way he feels. And you know, God really wants you to tell him who you are. I think this is very important. I think it's like saying to God, "I want you to cure my withered arm," but you're not willing to put it out there. I think it's to say, "Jesus, I really want to touch the hem of your garment like that little woman who followed you, and you were in a crush of people. They were all pushing, and suddenly you stopped and you said to your apostles, 'Who touched me?'" And they say, "Did you really ask that question? Who touched you? Everybody's touching you." He said, no, "Somebody touched me with a special touch because I felt my healing power go out from me. I really need that healing power, Jesus. And in the contact of our prayer, I have to really open myself. I have to really tell God who I am before God can touch me. If I go with that mask of the sweetest sentiments of faith, hope, and charity and all that, how can he touch you? You haven't stood there naked before him. How can his healing power get through your mask?" So I think it's very important, and I try to do that. I have found this very successful. And some days I sit on the edge of my bed when I get up and I say, "Hey, I don't feel like being a priest today. They're gonna devour me. I know that. I get paranoid." I think I know how you felt about those 9 lepers who never came back, you know? And other days I say, "Hey, do I feel great today? I feel all the exhilaration of the priesthood." And I say, "Where are the mountains you want moved?" You know, I have my ups and downs, as everybody does. But the point is, you've got to present that person to God. And then, now, this is really important. How does God speak to us? How does God come back? I can't imagine someone really having a profound relationship with God if all he does is throw words over a wall and say, "I hope you're over there." How does God speak to you? Now, this is what happens to me. Now, you may choose to debate my sanity in private, you know, or you may think, "Oh, I wish God would talk to me the way he talks to him. Who does he think he is?" You know, pay your money and take your choice. But what I think is that God has 5 ways of communicating with us. He can put an idea in your mind. He can put in your will either strength that you've never had before or desires. He can put into your emotions peace if you're troubled or trouble if you're peaceful. God comes not only to comfort the afflicted, but to afflict the comfortable. No, it's true, he might shake you up a little, right? He can put words into your imagination. You know, you can hear words inside of you that God has really stimulated your imagination to hear. This was the whole issue in the trial of Joan of Arc. In George Bernard Shaw's play, St. Joan, Robert says to Joan, "Joanie, do you hear the voice of God?" She said, "Yes." Joan, he said, "You know, you really don't. You know what you hear? You're hearing the voice of your imagination." And she said, "That's right." And he said, "Joan, would you make up your mind?" And she said, "That's the way God speaks to us. God can stimulate your imagination to hear his words. And God can stir up memories. They say that love is 50% intuition and 50% memory. That love demands a history. And God can remind you, I have loved you. Don't you see, as you remember your life, all those zigs and zags, I was loving you. All I ask is that you remember me as loving you." Now, after opening yourself to God, after really putting yourself in the presence of God by this self-disclosure, that's the primary gift of love. This is who I am. Touch me. Heal me. Please, God, send your spirit into me to illuminate whatever is darkened, to heal whatever is sick, to mend whatever is broken, to revive whatever is dead. Here I am, God. Here I am. I have a Protestant minister friend, Reuel Howe. He wrote a great book called The Miracle of Dialogue. He said, "I lie for 15 minutes every day on my back, my face up to God and my arms out, and I say to him, if you have anything to say to me, I am ready to listen." And he said, "And some days God speaks to me, and it's beautiful, and some days God doesn't speak to me, and so I come back tomorrow, and that's beautiful too. But what I have experienced is that suddenly ideas will come to me. If I remain passive, if I put those antennae of reception out to God, of my mind, of my will, of my emotions, of my imagination, of my memory. And I have described this in a little book called He Touched Me. And recently a lady wrote to me and she said, I thought this was so beautiful. She said, "You know, I was going to kill myself 10 years ago. I had led a bad life, and I needed to die. And I wanted to throw myself into the ocean. I fantasized the ocean as the mother who would rock me forever. A warm, watery mother. When I got to the ocean at Odessa Beach, South Carolina, the ocean was a beast. It was hissing and snarling, but I knew I had to die. And I heard a voice within me, and the voice said, 'Stop, please, turn around and look down.' And I did. And I could see the water washing up over my footprints on the sand of the rim of the ocean. And the voice said, 'Just as you see the water washing away your footprints in the sand, so has my love and mercy erased all of your past. Be at peace. I am calling you to live and to love, not to die.'" And she said, I turned away from the ocean. I turned away from death. I turned away from all thoughts of suicide. And I have found a very fulfilling life now. A very beautiful life. But it was all based on the fact that it really was God's voice. And I couldn't entrust that grace to any other human judgment. I couldn't say to one of my friends, "This is what happened," because I was always afraid they would say to me, "You made it up. You were only hearing echoes of your own imagination. In your cowardice, you didn't want to die. You didn't really want to die. So you made up a voice to save you." The way they told St. Joan of Arc that she had made up a voice. And so I could only go back to God. And I asked him, "Please, would you give me a sign?" And I just want you to know this, that as I read the last page of your book, He Touched Me, I heard the voice again. This was your sign. And I just want to tell you that in my own life has been largely shaped by this kind of dialogical prayer. About 5 years ago, I received a grace this way that has left me a changed person. God keeps converting me and changing me day by day. It never seems to be over. I, In the poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland, Jared Manley Hopkins says to God, over again, I feel thy finger and find thee. And that's the way I feel, that God's hand keeps reaching again and again into my life to touch me. About 5 years ago, my father, provincial of the Jesuits in the Chicago area of the United States, appointed me and two other theologians to go to all the Jesuit houses in the Middle West of the United States to address the Jesuits on this topic. Can Jesus be preached today as he was 25 years ago? Are devotions like the Sacred Heart devotion still viable in preaching Jesus? And one of the theologians was trained in the scriptures, and one was a speculative theologian, and I was to be the pastoral theologian. And so the other two went first, and I gave my presentation last. And we were going around to the Jesuit houses and doing all right, and I felt it was a routine assignment until we came to Loyola University in Chicago, where I teach, and there are 120 Jesuits there. And so I stood up before the Jesuits in my own community, and I was nervous. And I have to tell you this, that I am almost never nervous in a speaking situation. I told you last week, or last Tuesday, that I have a lot of mileage on my mouth. And so I'm never nervous. But this night I was nervous. And so I listened to my nervousness, and I asked myself, what is the emotion under the nervousness? And I knew what it was. I really wanted to succeed that night. I wanted those Jesuits to know how good I am. They had never heard me speak. You know I'm good, I know I'm good, but they didn't know. And I wanted little Fulton Sheen, you know, to come out from under wraps and say, this is what the gem you have had in your midst, my brothers. And so I said to Jesus, Would you put your hands out over my life and my emotions and give me peace, please? And nothing happened. So I went back and I said, excuse me, I don't mean to be impolite. But you did say whatever we asked in your name and nothing happened. And once I read this, and it's helped me a great deal, someone said, if you keep asking God the same question and get no answer, try another question. So I said to him, are you trying to tell me something? And I heard these words. I heard these words clearly inside me. I don't ask you to believe them, believe that I heard these words. If you do, fine. If you don't, it's all right. Pay your money, take your choice. But I heard these words, and they have changed me. The words were, you are getting ready to give another performance. And I must say there was an immediate flush of embarrassment when I heard the word performance. My life has been filled with performances. And the voice of Jesus, stimulating my imagination, purely interior, said, I don't need any more performances. What I need from you is acts of love. You're getting ready to perform for your brothers so they will know how good you are. They don't need that. They need you to love them so they will know how good they are. And I looked out at my brothers. I looked out at the ones who are forcibly retired by a mandate of the university, that feel like they're on the shelf and nobody ever comes to them. There are no captive classes anymore. I looked at them and felt their sadness. And I looked out at the ones who are physically sick. When they get out of bed in the morning, every day is a new agony. I looked at the ones who are alcoholic, whose hands shake in the morning, and who go to Alcoholic Anonymous meetings at night, and they're embarrassed. I looked out at the ones who fail at almost everything they undertake. Their students don't like them. Nobody ever seems impressed with their sermons. I looked out at my brothers, the old and the young and the sick and the weak, and I felt very ashamed that I had wanted so badly to impress them. And I said to them, my brothers, I'm going to love you. I'm going to love you. And when you love, when you really go out to other people, when you really say, oh, I hope I can say something that will make your life more full. I hope I can say something that will be a port of entry for God to enter your life and to touch you. Oh, I really want you to know how good you are and how much God loves you. then all the nervousness that night disappeared. And I just want to tell you this in leaving you, that before I came out here tonight, as I have done for almost before everything I have done in the last 5 years since God said that to me, I have prayed that I would not give any more performances. And I prayed just beyond that door with a priest whom I have come to love here that tonight it would not be a performance, but an act of love. And I hope that whatever I have said has helped you. But I really want you to know this. I have loved you. Thanks for listening.